This is Dr. Michael Bricky with Ageless Lifestyles Radio, cutting-edge thinking for being youthful at every age. On each program, I interview experts on what it takes to live longer, healthier, and happier. Our program takes a holistic approach in addressing anti-aging psychology, medicine, alternative medicine, fitness, nutrition, and wellness. Our emphasis is on innovative thinking and practices that have solid data and results. You work for the same company for decades, and in a touching ceremony with pathos worthy of a scene from Goodbye, Mr. Chips, they give you a gold watch. Well, so much for nostalgia. Today, it's you work for a company for several years, the business is sold or downsized or outsourced, and you're job hunting. Again. Welcome to today's job market. Today, career coach and executive search expert Dr. Beth Ross shares how to find a great job in today's job market. We'll look at what's different about the market today, how to take advantage of the changes, being clear about what you want, how to find the job, and how to manage the application and interview process. Dr. Ross, welcome.
Thank you.
With the recession and all the economic problems, a lot of people are in a panic. How badly are the economic problems affecting the job market now?
Well, let's see. I think the only answer that I can give you from my vantage point is that effect is as bad as you let it be. I have clients right now who are getting interviews and offers and great jobs. It's a funny time. It's as if, oh goodness, I don't want to risk doing this, but it's a great time to do it.
If anything, some of your competition may be scared off?
Yeah, some of your competition may be absolutely sitting in a panic and listening to the best advice would be don't listen to the TV. They'll tell you just how bad it is. And sure, this is unprecedented, but it's a time of real opportunity for people who are serious about managing and moving forward their careers.
Have some of the employers been more interested in contracting out or contracting for consulting services because of financial insecurities?
Well, that started a long time back before we had the general panic that we have right now. It's one of the things that is quite amazing about this thing of retirement. I have so many clients who retire 1 week and 2 weeks later they're back consulting with their former company. Companies love having consultants because it's a big tax write-off. They can use you for the product or project that they're having at one time, and then they can say, goodbye, we'll call you if we need you again. And on the other side of the fence, I have a whole cadre of people who now refer to themselves as permanent part-timers. They don't want to work full-time.
Mm-hmm.
They want to do this, and they figure out how to take care of their medical and their savings for retirement and so forth on their own. It works. It can work.
Now, if you were working for someone and wanted to change into that consultant role, how would you approach the employer about having that arrangement?
That's pretty sticky. The employer may not like it. In that case, you can get yourself fired really quickly.
Uh-oh.
Or the employer, on the other hand, the employer might say, wow, this is a wonderful way to get rid of him. We can keep him for what we need him for, and he won't be around in the whole political machinations of the company. So it's a very hard question to answer. Hey, this is one of the reasons you get a career coach, because two brains are better than one, and hopefully the coach brain is going to be very objective and also very experienced in guiding you through this process. It's scary.
And sounds like you should be pretty secure in how badly they need you before you propose something like that.
I would think that would be very sensible.
How much of a gray ceiling is there these days?
Wow, that's a hard one. Depends on the situation. Age discrimination exists, and if you think it doesn't, you're being unrealistic. You really don't. If you're over a certain age, you probably aren't going to get the chance to work at a company where there's a gray ceiling, and if you move into that, then you find your role really changing in the organization. It's not everywhere. There are some companies that love to have the background and experience of older workers. What is older? That's another interesting question. We're talking now about people having two, not one, but two middle ages. The first one between 35 and 40, and the next one between 55 and 60. It's as if between 55 and 60, we're seeing people who say, okay, now how do I want to spend the rest of my working days, which may be right till the day you drop, because we're living longer, we're healthier, but yeah, it's a different time in the workplace.
Are there particular industries that have more of a gray ceiling?
I'm not sure I can answer that accurately. Someone who really studies those demographics could give you a better answer. I don't have many people who talk about a gray ceiling. It's just not there. You just don't want to go to work for one of those companies.
I want to take you back to that wonderful Ronald Reagan quote, 1984, with Walter Mondale, when he said, I want you to know that I'm not going to make an issue in this campaign of age. I'm not going to exploit, for political purposes, my opponent's youth and inexperience. Are there ways that people can present their age with a positive spin?
Absolutely, yes. Now, here's one of the things I tell my clients about. Not only age, gaps in their resume. I really stress telling the truth. If you've got something that's going to come out, here's what I say to them. If you can't fix it, feature it. If you're over a certain age, it used to be 50. I can't even say 50 anymore because nobody's looking at 50 as old anymore. It just,
good.
It just doesn't happen. But if you spent 2 years canoeing on the Congo and that's a gap in your resume, for goodness sakes, find a way in the interview to mention it. Certainly in a positive context, talk about all the things you learned, how much stronger this has made you as a worker and as a thinker and as a doer and so on. If you mention it first, you don't have to be defensive about it. If you wait until they sort of walk around it, whatever it is, then you've got a problem. Now, nobody is going to sit in an interview and say, I kind of noticed from your experience here that you must be over 50 or over 55 or something. Oh, and that's another thing. Don't ever do on your resume. Put all your experience on there. Because if you try to act like you got out of college on the resume, try to act like you graduated from college in 1989, they can look at you and tell you didn't. So don't try it. It backfires every time.
So it's like in politics where they say, define yourself before your opponents define you.
I hadn't heard that one, but it's a good one.
I read in some of the personnel literature that they're anticipating this huge brain drain as the baby boomers retire. Are employers really concerned about that yet, or is it just going to blindside them?
I personally have not seen much concern about that right now. I think we've got too many other things on the plate. It's an interesting thought, though. I think the one thing we've learned in recent weeks is that, indeed, no matter what the politicians say or don't say, change is inevitable. And when that brain drain hits, then there will be a lot more attention paid to it than there is right now, I think.
The scariest places that's going to hit is back with Ronald Reagan again, when he fired so many air traffic controllers.
Yeah, I remember.
They're predicting that 60% of the air traffic controllers are going to retire or be promoted in the next 8 years.
I've heard that statistic. It's very thought-provoking, isn't it?
It makes you a little timid about flying, yes.
A little timid about flying, but hey, if you're a job seeker, I think that kind of training might be really interesting, don't you?
Well, that's one where they've had a mandatory retirement age of, I think, 55, and they're just starting to raise it. So for baby boomers, that's not the best direction to go. With executive jobs, are employers looking for different skill sets than they were looking for 10 years ago, or is it basically the same?
Well, it depends on what industry you're talking about. Well, at the executive level, you've got a background and experience record that is going to make you either qualified or not qualified for executive positions. If you're in retail, it could be one thing. If you're in hospital administration, it could be something else. If certainly the banking financial world is crumbling before our eyes, and these people are needing to retread themselves into, in some cases, another industry.
Mm-hmm.
And figuring out how your skills are transferable is very, very important. I don't know. 10 years ago, I was, as you can see from my website, my background is retained executive search. So I was looking for top executives, particularly in the Silicon Valley area. I don't think that that has changed in the last 10 years, but what has really changed is the technology. So therefore, a whole new set of skills and expertise would be required for top jobs.
So you're talking about understanding computers, or at least how to use what computers can do.
Well, not just computers. Technology has gone way beyond that now. I think that everything from security to everything you're going to ever need is going to be in a telephone, not on a computer.
Mm-hmm.
This is big. The digital world is vast now.
Taking the example of that person who had a high-level financial job and it's disappeared, and they say, well, I've got to find a whole new career, how does a person go about that?
Well, hopefully a person won't try to go about it alone. Again, here's my recommendation. Get yourself the best executive and career coach that you possibly can, because you need to start out with a complete assessment of what your skills are. I work with my clients like this initially to figure out what lights them from within. In many cases, people end up on career paths that they're very successful at. They make lots of money. Things are peachy keen, and then all of a sudden the world goes upside down, and they've got to figure out something else to do. And I find that this is the time in life, whether some of these people are in their late 20s, others are much more mature, and it's a time to really stop and think, okay, what are my real skills? What do I love to do? It's unthinkable to most Americans that they can love what they do, get paid well for it, and really be happy at it. Lots of people hate their jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm not saying that this is true of everybody who ends up at the wrong place at the wrong time, and sometimes it's pretty bittersweet to have to reinvent yourself, really, to do something else. But if you have a certain skill set that has made you an ace in the financial world, trust me, those skills will transfer to something else. And you've got to work with somebody or some group that's going to help you get a handle on what that might be. And that needs to happen fast. It's not something that can drag out, because we all need to support ourselves.
So, well, there's probably a million people out there calling themselves coaches. How do you find somebody who's really, really good as opposed to somebody who's just okay?
Boy, that's a big one, too. I hope there's not a million coaches there. Well, okay, I wrote an article not long ago about how do you pick a coach. That was before we were in what we're in right now. It's like before 2 weeks ago and after 2 weeks ago. But I two of the things that I said in there, most people find us through the internet, and there are a lot of people that you can find and read about, and but everybody's going to give a phone number. If you go to my website, which is www.bethross.com, you will see my 800 number, you will see my email address, but more importantly, you're going to see my background and experience. Now, you got to pick someone whose experience you respect and resonate with. And I am very unusual as a career coach. Most career coaches are either therapists or have been, and there's nothing wrong with that, nothing at all. But if you need a shrink, you got to go to someone else. I tell my clients I'm a pragmatic business person. My background is retained executive search. So for years, I have known job market.
Well, let me stop you. First of all, retained executive search means an employer comes to you and says, give me a university president or give me a chief financial officer.
And then there is a contract. You have that exclusively. Confidentiality is honored to the highest degree. There are other kinds of recruiters who work on a contingency basis and pass resumes around and so on. And at a certain mid-level area, that is absolutely fine. And some of these people are just absolutely great. Well, it's like anything else. Some of the recruiters are great and some of them aren't. Some of the coaches are great and some mm-hmm. of them aren't. You do this business of picking a coach just like you do any high-ticket purchase, so to speak, because it is going to cost you money. So don't go for the cheapest person, because that may not necessarily be the best. But it's also going to mean you're going to have homework. You're going to have to work. You will need to understand and respect the protocol and methodology that coach is going to use.
The internet part kind of scares me, because anybody with 100 hours can have a decent website.
So, not really. Those websites are terrible.
There's so many CAN programs that
there are
pretty
and you
decent.
Can spot one a mile away when you see it. Believe me, the thought that went into my website, I take no credit for it at all. The guys in California who did it for me I've never even laid eyes on them, but they were, you know, it was a recommendation kind of thing. Mm-hmm. They did a superb job of professionally presenting me, my background, my qualifications, and information that would be helpful to people who go to the site.
So when you're trying to pick a coach, do you get them on the phone and interview them?
Yes, you do speak to them on the telephone, keeping in mind that coaches do work generally on an hourly basis. It took me a long time to learn that after 20 minutes, I have to say to people, you know, this is going to turn into a paid consultation, because some people will call you and really try to talk forever trying to find out what you're doing, and you can't tell everything. I have a very good, and I hope to the point, outline that I really share with people when they phone. And you don't say the same thing to everyone who phones, because people's needs are different. For instance, one of the biggest parts of my practice is interview training, and has been for the last year. Now, why is that? I'm not sure I know, but I do know. People come to me who find that they get just through the first interview and never get to the second. And they're completely mm-hmm. ignorant about the fact that the purpose of an interview is never to get a job. It's to get the next meeting, because that first person who interviews you is not a decision maker, usually.
Okay, so it sounds like before you even call somebody, you want to do your own mental assessment of what's the weakest part of my job strategy. Is it figuring out what I want to do? Is it the interview process?
It might be your resume.
Might be resume. And then look for a coach who's particularly strong in that. And then it sounds like it would be fair to call them and say, may I have 10 minutes to ask you a few questions to see if you're the person that I'm looking for?
Sure, absolutely.
Once you have an idea of what the job is that you're looking for, how do you go about finding it?
Oh, that's when it gets really interesting. The first thing I do with my clients is the assessment part, but the second thing is something we call targeting. Now, a target has three parts: geographical, type and size of company, number two, and three, the kind of position you're going after. Start my clients with a very small number of targets, geographically and suiting the other qualifications also. And I work with them on a protocol that enables them to get in front of decision makers, not to ask for a job, but to ask for information. It's the building up of a very sophisticated networking system, and it works. We work very hard on a cover letter and also getting the resume in great form as a professional presentation. You know, a resume gets 20 to 40 seconds of perusal if mm-hmm. you're lucky.
Gee, this is as tough as dating.
Yeah, it's worse. The first page has to be so compelling that the person looking at it can't take their eyes off of it. Even more important than the resume is the cover letter. Not really more important, but it can be of equal importance. Because that cover letter has to say why you've picked them, that you want to speak with them, And we, you know, it can take as many as 8 phone calls to get this interview, but it works, and I've worked it with people who are just newly out of school, well, a little bit more than that, 2 or 3 years experience, to very senior level executives. That's where it works best. But it's a different approach. You know, people get jobs in 4 different ways.
Okay, well, let me slow you down. So on a cover letter, what are some big mistakes that people commonly make?
They start every paragraph with I.
Whoops.
That is an absolute no-no. Keep I out of there. Nobody's interested. A cover letter has 4 paragraphs. I have a template that I give to my clients. I can tell you what you put in paragraph 1, 2, 3, and 4, and then you say sincerely, and it must never be more than 1 page.
Mm-hmm. And what are the biggest mistakes people make on resumes?
They go on and on like War and Peace. And their margins go out to the left and out to the right. There's no white space. It's clutter. No one wants to read it because it's too convoluted. They tell everything. The worst question that people face in an interview, too, is that question, tell me about yourself. They don't want to know where you went to kindergarten. They want to know in less than 2 minutes who you are and what you're about and why you would be perfect in an environment such as the one that you're talking about.
Almost like an elevator speech.
That's an old-fashioned term for it, yeah, or a pitch or whatever, yeah.
Mm-hmm. There are all the job boards on the Internet. Which kind of positions and level of salary or whatever is that most effective with?
You know, that's a fascinating question. And the answer just depends... I know I sound like I'm evading it, but I'm not. Depends. Here's the thing. I've just worked with an executive in sort of multimedia business, and that the PR people in that and the media people tend to watch those job boards, and they all know each other here in New York anyway, and so much happens via the job boards. In other instances, if you send your resume into a listing on a job board, it is going into a black hole. They are not required by law or anything else to get back to you, and many times they do not. I was working with one of my corporate clients recently when I knew that they had put up a listing on the Internet and that the CEO had given the orders to the temp who was picking up those resumes, pick up the first 60, put the rest of them in the trash.
Hmm.
Now, that's the worst possible scenario. Let me tell you another story that really makes me blush. So I'm set telling people, oh, don't do the job boards. But look, sometimes it happens. It happened in my own family 5 years ago. My son answered a listing on Monster. He got a call from a recruiter halfway across the country. He was absolutely right for a position. They moved him from the West Coast to Texas, full relocation, salary increase, benefits, vacation, all kinds of stuff. And so I had to say, oh, my gosh.
Made a believer of you, huh?
It happened in my own family, so what am I going to do? It's another one of those questions that you just can't answer. The one thing, you know, at people at an executive level, I say, don't post your resume.
Mm-hmm.
Some people post their resume on Monster or something. You'll get calls from all kinds of recruiters, and if they have their hands on that resume, they're going to send it around all over the place. It's going to make you look desperate. You're going to lose out on any negotiation position you have. Oh, and that's another thing I do a lot of, working with people on salary negotiation.
Well, let's take that as an opportunity to say that we're talking with Dr. Beth Ross, who does career counseling, executive coaching, and coaching on the nitty-gritty issues like interviewing, resume writing, salary negotiation, and also your professional speaker.
Oh, yeah, I do that.
And
I forgot.
You're based in New York City, but also do a lot of work in Silicon Valley.
Yeah, and actually, my telephone clients are global in scope. Right now I have a client in Singapore and I have one in Saskatchewan. So it just depends. Again, depends. And the one in Saskatchewan is doing academic interviews, which is a whole different world from the job interview thing as we know it for work. So it's a very varied client base, and it varies at any time. You know, some people you get finished with, and they go away, they never come back. Some people you get finished, they come back later when they're having concerns about managing their career and so on. That's always nice.
Just like kids, you throw some out and some come back and some don't. Website is BethRoss.com, just BethRoss.com. We'll get back to Dr. Ross in just a minute. Tired of your organization having the same old pep talks from a motivational speaker? I love making presentations that challenge conventional thinking about aging and help people adopt beliefs that help them think, feel, look, and be more youthful. When you think younger, it shows in your posture, your demeanor, facial expressions, and energy level. And when you feel better, you'll look more youthful and you'll look more attractive. And when that happens, people even treat you better. Let me help you and your employees or colleagues think, feel, look, and be more youthful too. Check out my demo video at antiagingspeaker.com. That's anti-aging-speaker.com. Or give me a call. My phone number is on all my websites. To learn more about any of my services, speaking, personal coaching, books, hypnosis CDs, or my free Defy Aging newsletter, just go to my portal site, notaging.com, notaging.com, and it'll link you to whatever you want. And a reminder, all the previous shows are archived on agelesslifestyles.com, where you can see a summary, guest pictures, find links mentioned on the show, and download or stream the MP3. And finally, be sure to catch my free one-hour teleseminar on October 14th at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on how to use anti-aging psychology to be more youthful. Free registration is at healthteleclass.com. And if you missed that link, you can find it at agelesslifestyles.com or notaging.com. And now back to Dr. Ross. I want to get back to those job boards. Do a lot of them scan for certain phrases, and if you don't put in the right phrase, you're lost?
Absolutely. So when I work with people, depending on what their industry is, we talk a lot about what those buzzwords are. Because if they're going to scan, and particularly at the lower-level positions and mid-level positions, the scanner is king of everything. And if you don't have the right words in there, there's a lot of scanning done.
So it's almost like keywords on the internet. You really need to think out which phrases to use.
Yeah. And you look at what the job descriptions say, and sometimes what the job descriptions don't say. We marvel at who might write these things. Another thing that happens, and you have no control over this. There are certain recruiters who will put job descriptions on job boards just to bring in candidates. Mm-hmm. So that they have a candidate supply when something comes up. There are also companies that will float something on their website just to see what the traffic will bear and what comes in. That's pretty extreme stuff, but it does happen. And the internet is wonderful, and then there's some other things that you really can't control.
Sure.
And it does happen.
I assume that most of the company web postings postings for jobs are legitimate. Any suggestions?
And here's another thing. Remember, they are the postings that they have are legitimate. Sometimes they fill a position and they don't take the posting off soon enough. But one of the things you can always be sure of is there's a posting for a job, say in marketing or sales or IT, whatever it is. There are more jobs. They don't put them all out there, particularly if they're very hot ticket jobs. Sometimes they have a search firm that may be working, behind the scenes on this, or they another thing. They might be in a position where internally they're getting ready to fire someone,
mm-hmm.
and they can't put that position up on their website because that would tip the hand. They don't want that person to go until they get a candidate. All kinds of machinations go on in this world of recruiting and job search.
So it's not only a place where you can apply for a job, but also a hint as to other activity that's probably going on there that you can try to approach them directly about.
Yes, and also for other activity going on, if you're really interested in a company, be sure when you go to their website that you click on, if they have a thing for press releases and so on, because that's going to give you an idea of how they've been in the media. And two, when you Google the name of the company, you'll get those media things also. But information is really power. When you go for an interview, you need to, I tell people, you need to act and dress the part. You really need to have a sense of what that corporate culture is like. And if you want to work there, figure out how you can appear from minute one to fit in there.
Any suggestions on when to use recruiters and how to work with recruiters?
Oh, dear. Well, there are all kinds of recruiters. We've already talked about that at all and when to look at recruiters. I was starting to say a few minutes ago about the four different ways people get jobs. We've talked about one of those ways, ads. Right now, when we say ads, it's not newspaper ads anymore. Everything is on the Internet. So that's one way to get jobs. Second way to get jobs is through recruiters. And there's everything in recruiting from employment agencies. They usually do the entry-level, very entry-level, order clerk kind of jobs and so forth, to contingency recruiters that run the gamut from, compensation levels of, say, 50,000, sometimes up to 100, but rarely. Sometimes up to 100. When you get to the 100K thing, it's going to be retained executive search, and that's a whole different ball game. So the recruiting stuff will fall in there somewhere. Now, I get a lot of clients who, by the time they come to see me, they already have recruiters after them. They're probably in some visible industry or job title whereby they've been talking to recruiters for several years, perhaps, and perhaps they've actually used recruiters themselves to hire people, so they know each other. Recruiting is definitely a relationship kind of thing. Be sure you really trust your recruiter and trust the recruiter's expertise. They do find people great jobs. Now, one of the things you lose when you're working with a recruiter is your ability to negotiate your salary. Forget it. The recruiter's going to find out what you were making, and they're going to negotiate your compensation because they want it to go up as high as they can to get their fee, especially the contingency recruiters. And this can be a problem. I tell my clients when we're talking about salary negotiation, the first person who mentions money loses. Any lawyer will tell you that. If somebody's interviewing you and they're gauche enough to lean across the table and say, okay, what's it going to take? I'm going to tell you what you say to that. You look at them and smile and say, we're having such a great time talking about this position. It sounds wonderful. I'm thrilled to be here. This is the company of my dreams. Let's keep talking about this job because I know if this company, XYZ, makes me an offer, it's going to be fair and equitable. Now, you won't necessarily get away with that script, but you see what I'm getting at. Postpone money discussions as long as you can.
Well, that answer also was a nice way of saying the job is more important to me than money, but you know, we'll be business-alike about it when the time comes.
And we're in a strange time right now. I mean, when a job is a job is a job. So every one of my great pronouncements has its sort of caveat to go with it. But these are basic things that if you remember, they usually hold up pretty strongly.
Back at looking for the job, we had your two strategies, ads and recruiters. What was number three?
Oh, I'm sorry, yes. Ads, thank you. Ads, recruiters, networking, which is always true. I mean, that's how you get good doctors. You say, who's looking at your ears or something or other. So networking. And then the fourth way for getting jobs, and it's the one that I really advocate and I really work with my clients on, is direct contact. You can get direct contact with anybody.
Wow. How do you do
and
that?
I know how to teach it. What?
How do you do that?
Oh, no, I'm not going to tell you.
not on the first date, huh?
For career coaching. But it is definitely possible, and it's possible to do it in a very ethical way that will, the best part of this whole process is that in doing it, you're building a lifetime network. Networking is something that most people do not understand. It's a give and take. It's not just to grab the information and run. it is a lifetime commitment to not only getting help from whoever you're talking to, but letting them know in a subtle and often direct way that, hey, you're there to help them too.
Well, let's get to the interview process. You know they're going to ask you questions. How do you anticipate and guess what questions they're going to ask you so you can prepare well?
Oh my gosh, I've got stacks and stacks and stacks of mock interviews, depending on what the job description is. I put those things together. You know, people are, Garrison Keillor said something really, really true about interviewing. He says, most people approach interviewing as if they've been captured by the enemy and they're going in for an interrogation. And it's true. Several months ago, I had a very high-level executive here in New York come to me, called me up, just said he wanted interview training. I started my spiel about what it's like. He didn't want to hear that. He just wanted to do it because he knew somebody else who I had worked with. So he gets there, and this is a high-level executive who's going to have to interview internally in his company with peers to effect a huge promotion. I said, George, what are your concerns? What's bothering you? He says, Beth, I'm afraid if I open my mouth, nothing will come out.
Uh-oh.
Now, here's a man who's been interviewing people himself for years and years and years, and he's going to be interviewing with his peers. And on first glance, you would think, oh, he shouldn't be scared of these people. But the truth is, it's terrifying.
Oh, we're often more scared of our peers' judgment than strangers. I mean, we can walk away from the strangers, not have to see them again.
You know that wonderful question that they ask you, what are your strengths?
Mm-hmm.
And of course you know about your work ethic, your accomplishments, and so on. But they will still ask that awful question, what are your weaknesses? And I tell my clients, I'm here to tell you, you have no weaknesses. If they ask you that question...
if they torture you, you still have no weaknesses.
You still have no weaknesses. You can always turn a lemon into lemonade. You say, you know, sometimes my really strong work ethic gets the better of me and I work too long and too hard and reach burnout, but I'm really working on that. But basically, you just got to... This sounds so simplistic, this whole business of remembering that you have no weaknesses. Good grief, you're not going to admit to them. Just don't do it. Their questions can really... I'm thinking as an example right now of a young lady who's very high up in the credit card industry and absolutely brilliant, poised, well-paid, fantastic recommendations. They're selling off her division, so she's going to be looking for something else in the same industry. She is absolutely terrified of behavioral interviewing, which is something that is taught to managers.
You mean like stress interviewing?
What?
You mean stress interviewing, where they try to make you uncomfortable?
No, I wouldn't call it stress. It's not like Adam Rickover, who used to nail chairs to the floor so that the candidate was staring out a window into bright sunlight. No, it's not that bad. But it's a certain, you know, I recognize it the minute I see it, and she does too, and she knows she's going to be in trouble. It's, give me an example of one of those times when you failed and how you turned it around. Now, somehow you can oftentimes script the answers to these stupid, and it is a stupid question, but you can figure out the answer they want to hear and the whole business. But she gets really, really emotional when these things, again, I'm not a therapist, probably goes back to her childhood, but when these things are thrown to her in interviews. So we've gone through several sessions of just me coming up with these types of questions. You need to prepare for all that stuff you're afraid they'll ask, because as I said a few minutes ago, they will ask those impossible questions. Though some people still ask, what was the last book you read? Now, believe it or not, that question really throws some people.
Mm-hmm.
If they haven't read a book in 2 or 3 months.
Or 2 or 3 years.
Or if it's not exactly. You know, you want to be reading the right thing, right?
Oh, jeez.
It's not the right answer. It's not, oh, I read the Bible every night or something.
So it sounds like it's practice, practice, practice.
It's practice, and you know something, it's emotional. The whole thing is emotional because it just is. There you are sitting with somebody who has your life in the palm of their hand. The worst thing is this first interview when somebody from Human Resources, some Human Resources people are saints, you know, in every way and perfect in what they do, and others you just wonder, whoa, how did they ever get there? But this person, him or her, may actually be the if you can't get past the first interview, you're not going to get that job.
It sounds like right before you go in the interview, you need to get yourself in the right mindset where you're feeling really confident, you're feeling you can handle anything.
That's what a coach is for.
You're feeling relaxed. Oh, you're ready to take them on.
Yeah, and practice doesn't necessarily make perfect, but it makes a lot better. Anticipating what's going to happen. Oh, another thing, too. You need to be able to have, well, of course, one is going to be really prepared for an interview, but you need to know everything you can possibly know about that company.
Right.
It's so easy now. I can remember a time when, oh, my God, if there was a company, we would have to call up and ask for an annual report to be sent and all kinds of stuff. Now, with just within minutes on the Internet, you can practically know everything that you ever need to know. But being prepared and have some questions, because at the end of every interview, they will say, do you have any questions? And I've known people who were absolutely X'd out of consideration because they shook their head and said no.
You just get this, duh.
You write those questions on a 3x5 index card or a little pad or something and stick it in your pocket. You will never pull it out. But the very fact that you have spent the time to write out questions, put them in your pocket, and the whole business, it's close to you. It's just a little trick that makes it work. And during an interview, I advise people to have a pad and a pen, small, with them, especially if it's multiple people you're interviewing with, because you're not going to remember afterwards who said what. And afterwards, you are not going to write a thank you note. You're going to write an influencing letter.
So on this pad of paper you have, you're literally going to be taking notes, and they're not going to be offended by that.
No. Nope.
If anything, they can see that as being conscientious.
Yeah, it works. It does. I don't get any negative feedback from it, because you need to write a note, a different note, to every person who interviews you, and you need to do it very quickly and stress the areas that were very compatible. But if there are any areas of concern, then you as the candidate, and you will discuss with me as the coach how we're going to handle that area of concern, and you will wipe that concern away in that influencing letter. It's a very important letter, follow-up.
So the notes are not generic. They're very specific to each
person.
And whatever issues you need to kind of preempt or address.
Absolutely.
One of the things I heard you talk about once was actually interviewing the interviewers, having some questions that you want to ask them. So those go
in
your 3x5 cards as well?
Yeah, you can put them there, but I work with my clients very carefully on rehearsing what those questions may be. You don't have to have that many questions. Certainly no more than 5, and 3 is a lot better. But you have to remember that in that interview you're going to be learning new things about the jobs, because nobody writes a good job description anymore, it seems. So you're really going to find out what the duties and responsibilities are. And sometimes after you get past the first interview, in the second or third meeting, as they learn more about you and more about your skills and your background, it's quite possible, and I've had this happen in recent weeks several times. The clients got job offers for a job that hadn't been advertised. It was one of those unadvertised ones, and it was actually more responsibility, more money, and, you know, a great synergy happened there in those interviews. This is why interviewing is so important. It doesn't stop after one.
Finally, how do you wrap up an interview?
You don't wrap it up. They do.
Okay. I know one of the things you encourage people to get in is to ask them about the process, what's next, how many people are being considered.
Oh, Oh, that's very important. I'm so glad you brought that up. My clients always sort of roll their eyeballs when I tell them this, and then they learn that it really matters. Your job is to kill off the competition. So you've got to ask, where are you in the interview process? Oh, heaven help you if you're the first one they're interviewing, because it's going to be a long time before you hear anything. You ask where they are in the process. You ask how many candidates that they're looking at. And then you say, and how do I stack up with the other candidates?
Ooh.
Now, hopefully, the person interviewing you will have a great sense of humor and just laugh when you say that, because they're not going to tell you that. But they might. They might. You never know who you're talking to. But it shows a great deal of intelligence that you want to know where is the process. And the last and most important thing that you do ask is, what is our next step? When will I hear from you? I get so many clients that they are calling me and saying, oh, gosh, it's been 72 hours and I haven't heard from them. And I say, well, what did they say? And he says, oh, I forgot to ask.
Again, it's as bad as dating.
And then there is that fine line between being responsive and being a pest. So you don't know whether to call, you don't know whether to email. What is the right time? Do you do it on Monday afternoon or Monday morning or Friday afternoon or what? Or is Wednesday the best day? And you can get into all sorts of machinations over this. But if you leave there without having asked what's the next step, you're sort of hanging in midair.
And besides that, you're going to beat them up about that. So.
Oh, yeah, big time. Because I do a complete breakdown afterwards, because if they're coming to me for interview training, by the time they come to me for interview training, guaranteed they've already had trouble. I wish people would come before they had trouble, but generally they don't. They think they'll save money and they think they're God's gift to interviewing, and they aren't necessarily. And so the thing is, if things aren't working, if you're not getting past the first interview, the big question is why. And if I can really debrief them right after, when they're still in emotional shock over what happened, because you know when you leave there whether or not you made a decent impression. You know on some level. And it can be something as simple as eye contact. I had one guy come to me and during our first interview, he was looking at the ceiling and out the window, and I thought, uh-oh, this is it. We got that fixed. I had to do mock interviewing with him when I would say, John, look at me. Look at me. Look at me. How many times? I'm surprised he took it, but he did. And finally got the thing nailed. But it takes a lot of practice. It can be something really small that's happening. And the best way to really know about that is to do a debriefing right after.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and another thing, too, that the candidates need to remember is that sometimes you can lose out on a job through no fault of your own.
Right.
And by that I mean suddenly somebody internally raises their hand, or the boss's cousin comes to town and suddenly needs a job, or. You can lose out in a contest for reasons that have nothing to do with you.
Certainly. Just don't take it personally kind of thing.
It's just easier said than done, isn't it?
Yeah. Dr. Ross, you're such a maven when it comes to jobs and executive coaching and all the nitty-gritties. I really appreciate you sharing a small fraction of your expertise with us. Again, you do executive coaching and coaching in some of the nitty-gritties like interviewing and resumes and salaries, also professional speaking. And the website is BethRoss.com, and really appreciate you sharing with us. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Your questions have been so good, and I hope that the answers will be really helpful to people who experience this. And thank you again for having me.
I'm sure just about everyone who listens got at least 3 or 4 good ideas.
I hope so.
Okay. Commentary. What can we say about the interview with Dr. Ross? I'm struck with the analogy between applying for a job and dating. In both cases, it's very important to know what you're looking for and where to look. on a date or in an interview, you're looking for indicators and often overread those indicators and try to base decisions on just small pieces of information that are probably overrated in terms of their predictability. Most people are nervous on a first date or in a job interview, and it's easy to psych yourself out of it, and just one bad habit can blow the whole date or blow the whole interview. How many dates have been blown for lack of a breath mint? Then there's computer dating. Instead of single white female seeks tall man for moonlight walks in a committed relationship, we get phrases like outside sales experience, Microsoft certified, and management experience. And if you don't put the right phrases in, you never get the date or you never get the interview. Personal ads are the counterpart of job boards like Monster.com, and recruiters are the counterpart of matchmakers. And so I guess career coaches are the counterpart of therapists. When your job application process isn't working, you go to a career coach, and when your relationship isn't working or interpersonal relationships aren't working well, you go to a therapist. In both cases, one of the keys is to put yourself in the other people's shoes and see what's going on from their perspective as well as yours. Thus, if you imagine yourself being the interviewer reading your cover letter, reading your resume, you're much more likely to make it friendly and make it easily to read and grasp what the key points are. Just as a resume or a cover letter that says I will blow in the chances of an interview, a first date that has I dominating the conversation isn't likely to go far either. A decade ago, if you talked about researching your date, it would have been pretty creepy. But now it's quite easy to go onto Facebook and LinkedIn and YouTube, and often you can learn a lot about your date before you even meet them. Just as it's easy to go online and learn a lot about a company and a lot about their key employees before you ever have that interview. In both cases, you can often do it in your pajamas. What a great world. Dr. Ross talked about the importance of anticipating questions and problems. You could say the same for dating, that you can have some things in mind to talk about and figure out some potential problems and how to finesse those. And at the end of the job interview, Dr. Ross wants us to ask how many others are being considered and how they're doing and what the next step is. No reason not to do that in dating as well. Otherwise, just like with job interviews, you're sitting by the phone wondering if the person's going to call. And I think it's much kinder and fairer to both parties to be candid about where you stand with each other. I gather that Beth sees applying for a job as a very competitive game, and she's very methodical and disciplined about it, with protocols and homework and practice and rehearsing. You need a plan, and every step of that plan needs to work. Just one glitch in the plan, and the whole process breaks down. And whether it's applying for a job or whether it's dating, you need a positive mindset, a feeling of confidence, being relaxed, being enthusiastic, and being interested in them as opposed to I. One thing that I don't quite agree with Dr. Ross on is she seemed to be coaching people to come up with the right answer, and the right answer being what the teacher wanted, or in this case, what the interviewer wanted. For example, what was the last book that you read? Well, she seemed to want you to come up with a book that would please them. I think it's important to be ourselves and be honest and tell them what the last book you read was, even if it's a comic book. One reason is I think people can tell when you're open and honest. When you're trying to come up with the right answers, you're more likely to see the wheels turning in the person's head, and it's just a little stiffer, and you just get vibes that it's not, you're not quite certain if it's really candid. A second reason is that you want it to be a good fit. If you portray yourself as somebody you're not, you may end up being very unhappy on the job when you're a different kind of person or from a different kind of culture than the corporate culture that they want. Sometimes finding a job is pretty straightforward because we know the market, we have a good network or a good Rolodex, or the career path is well defined. At other times, we can feel totally lost, or we have a series of disappointments. Something's not working. When we're lost, or when things don't seem to be working, career coaches like Beth Ross are a godsend. Baby steps. The purpose of Ageless Lifestyles is to help people live longer and healthier and happier. And one of the ways to get there is to do a little tweak in your behavior, a little tweak in your thinking that helps with that thinking, feeling, looking, and being more youthful. So the baby step for today is to ask yourself some of the employment interview questions, like, what do you say when they ask, what are your greatest strengths and weaknesses? Why is that a relevant baby step? Well, asking yourself employment questions gets your mind thinking, often unconsciously, so that if the time comes when you do need to seek a job, you have a better idea of what the best fit is for you because you've been mulling over those questions. The second benefit is that job hunting can be very stressful, and having given those questions some thought over time makes them familiar, less threatening, and makes the whole process a little easier when the time comes. Emails. I love getting emails. Emails on last week's show, Fire Your Personal Trainer, Be Your Own Trainer, with Dr. Mark Paulson and Ashley Marriott, I thought I was going to get lots of protests defending personal trainer. Instead, I got just a few listeners with concerns about how they often see people in gyms and fitness facilities using equipment unsafely or with little idea how to use it correctly. This is an excellent point. If you don't know how to use the equipment, by all means, get some help in it, get some training in it. Again, send those emails to radio@agelesslifestyles.com. And I want to remind you the previous programs are on webtalkradio.net. And all of the programs are archived on agelesslifestyles.com. I do hope you join me for my free one-hour teleseminar on October 14th, that's 9 p.m. Eastern Time, on how to use anti-aging psychology to be more youthful. Free registration is at healthteleclass.com. That's healthteleclass.com. And if you forget that, you can always go to notaging.com or agelesslifestyles.com to get the link. Hope to see you then. For information on any of my services, you go to notaging.com, notaging.com, where you can get a link to my free email newsletter, the Defy Aging newsletter, my books, hypnosis CDs, my personal coaching services, and my professional speaking services. Until next week, this is anti-aging psychologist Dr. Michael Bricky, thanking you for joining us on our quest to live longer, healthier, and happier.